But first, Chuck Klosterman. He's the pop culture critic known for books like Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and his memoir about growing up in North Dakota, Fargo, Rock City. His latest book is called Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. I had the chance to catch up with Chuck when he was in Milwaukee promoting his book, and he explained what he means by fictional nonfiction.
It almost seems consciously confusing, and it probably is, but you know, if you think about it, if you turned it around and it was called non-fictional fiction, it would still be fiction.
So what is the distinction between the two? Because I wondered about that.
Okay. It was typically in these situations, they just put stories at the bottom of the book. And I was like, I don't want to do that. So I sort of came up with this inside joke to myself, which of course is a questionable move to make. But there is one aspect of it, I suppose, that might be reflective of something that has meaning, and is that this is not a criticism of other fiction writers, but I typically don't like the way fiction is written.
Why? A
whole bunch of reasons. I mean, I tend to read almost exclusively nonfiction, partially for the practicality of it. You know, it's like the difference between a documentary film and a feature film. If they're both bad, it's still worthwhile to watch the documentary. You might get some information in reading. If you read something that's not, you know, non-fictional, but it doesn't matter how enjoyable it is, it's like you still might get something from it. That's part of it. But also, I think the bigger thing is, you know, nonfiction is written in a straightforward way where the principal goal is to communicate ideas. And very often in fiction, particularly modern literary fiction, the emphasis is on the structure of the prose and sort of the experience that's supposed to be edifying is the unpacking of that. This is written like nonfiction. So these are untrue stories, but I wrote them the exact same way I would have written stories if I had been told about a real event.
That makes sense. Yeah, and because they're so idea-driven.
Exactly.
Yeah, you want them to write them as nonfiction.
Because that's the other thing. Like,
yes.
Traditionally, they always say, like, if we were at a creative writing workshop, they would always say, you know, you start with character, and then you move to plot mechanics, and from that comes the idea. Mm-hmm. And I kind of work in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I start with the idea. The characters are character types.
Yeah.
Their job is to sort of exist within this created reality. The plot is less important than the concept.
Yeah. Many of the 34 stories in this book struck me as kind of a combination of Twilight Zone episodes and thought experiments. Was that something you were kind of going for with this?
I mean, that's definitely where I ended up. Like, if someone asked me, what are these stories like? I think comparing it to the Twilight Zone or Black Mirror would be the most sensible thing. Was I going for it? I'm not sure, because I didn't have total clarity of like what the idea of like how it was supposed to be as a whole when I started. But, you know, much like the Twilight Zone, where you watch an episode, and if we were talking about the original Twilight Zone, for example, we'd remember, oh, you know, William Shatner was in this episode, or Burgess Meredith, or we might remember certain stories, but what we'd really be talking about is kind of the world that was built for every episode. The idea that, like, it's set in reality with one thing different, or the idea of time has shifted or something like that. That is what these stories are like to me.
Raised in Captivity seems like such a creative departure from all your previous books. What were you trying to do different with this book?
I was a little embarrassed to talk about this because the answer will make me seem like kind of a lunatic, but it's the true thing. Okay, so I wanted to do this for a while, for probably 5 years. Anytime I had like a strange premise or like a kind of a, you know, like an interesting bit of dialogue I thought or overheard or whatever, the idea of a certain kind of character, I would put it into the notes app of my phone. Okay. So I had hundreds and hundreds of these. And then I came to what I thought was a brilliant decision. I'm going to use these ideas to write 100 stories that are exactly 1,000 words long. The entire thing was going to be 1,000-word stories, exactly 1,000. So I started doing that. And I did that a few times. I wrote a few stories and made sure they were exactly 1,000 words. But then I started to realize a few things. First thing I realized is all the stories were either being stretched up to 1,000 or cut down to 1,000. So every story was at an unnatural length. Then it occurred to me that this book would also be edited and copy-edited. So I'd have to go back in and add words or subtract words once again to get it back to this mystical 1,000-word length. And then I just finally realized this is stupid. What, who's going to care? Like, no one reads a book because the stories are the same length. It's like, yeah, I don't even know why I thought that was so interesting. I mean, I do like the idea of obstructions in writing. And I do also feel like because I had this secondary goal to begin with that was I was so conscious of, it probably did make me write faster and get more into it. Like, because the initial stories, you know, it's always hard to start sometimes when you're starting a new project, but I wasn't even thinking of the content. I was thinking like, I got to make sure this idea is compact enough to fit in this space. So that was the original conception. It would be 100 stories of 1,000 words, but now they're 34 stories of whatever length they're supposed to be.
Yeah, I think you made the right decision. And I'm wondering, I think maybe the reason you got sort of kind of fixated originally on wanting to do this was because as far as we know, it probably hasn't been done.
Well, I just thought it would be interesting. But, you know, it's interesting to someone for 40 seconds. Like, you know, even within that first minute, they're like, well, okay, that math thing was interesting that you did or whatever. And like, now why? And I'm like, oh, but they're 1,000 words. They're all 1,000 words. Like, that's all I'd be able to say about all of them.
Yeah, yeah. And instead of the usual head and shoulders about the author photo on the dust jacket, you did something different. You went to the Center for Medical Imaging in Hillsboro, Oregon, and had an x-ray taken of your head. My theory is that you did this because you wanted to convey the idea that you're giving us kind of exclusive inside access to the way your mind works and what being Chuck Klosterman is really like. Is that the case?
Maybe that's 1% of it.
Okay, what's
maybe another? Maybe 4% is that the title Raised in Captivity, I'm really talking about my brain, which I feel was raised in captivity. I don't feel like I necessarily have agency over how I think and feel. I don't think anyone does. I think that in a mediated culture, we have it's very difficult to know how you think or feel about anything. 95% of it, though, was that we had the cover art for the book and the back cover, which were both these kind of illustrations of skeletons. And I thought, like, well, what if my author photo was my actual skull? And I gotta say, it is more complicated to get a x-ray of your skull for no reason than you might think. You gotta go to your doctor, explain that you want this. She has to recommend you to, like, the imaging center. They had a lot of questions when I showed up, like they kept saying, it's like, well, there's nothing on here about what we're looking for. And in fact, it seems to suggest that you can tell us what you want to have x-rayed. Like, as is probably true, this had never happened to them before, that someone had came in for just a x-ray for aesthetics.
Yeah. So did you have to foot the bill for it?
Yep, $106 it cost.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? That seems cheap. That's a good deal on that. Can you tell me a bit about the title story, Raised in Captivity?
Raised in Captivity as a story. I've had a real fortunate life. You know, I can't sort of believe how things have worked out for me. And sometimes I feel real strange about it. And in the story, it's about someone who got a job and now they're flying first class. And they kind of sense that just being in first class somehow indicates that they're a different person now. And then they go to the bathroom and there is a puma in the lavatory. So he goes back and he talks to the rich guy sitting next to him. And to me, it's sort of about the confusion over class when you move from one class to another. Like, so often when people talk about socioeconomics and class, we operate almost as if a person exists in one tier of society and that is who they are forever. But people are always shifting this. You know, I was born probably, I guess, technically lower class. I lived a big part of my life middle class. Now I'm sure from if according to the IRS or whatever, I'm kind of living in the upper class or whatever. And so I feel like I do have a sense of how the economics of your reality do shape who you are. And that's kind of what the story is about. Now, to the person who reads it, it'll be like, this is just weird. But hopefully it's weird in a way that's entertaining.
Oh, it definitely is. And the class thing didn't register with me. But now that you've mentioned it, I've read the story a couple times, it makes sense. And my favorite section in this story occurs shortly after your protagonist has returned to his seat and he's talking to the older, richer guy sitting next to him about seeing the puma in the bathroom. And the older man asks the protagonist to theorize about how the puma ended up there. Would you mind reading an excerpt from this section?
Sure. Okay. The two men looked into each other's eyes, hunching their shoulders and leaning closer. The interaction adopted a conspiratorial tone. They spoke in stage whispers. The other passengers barely noticed and didn't care. "Tell me this," said the older man. "What are your theories?"
"My theories?
In terms of how this could have happened."
"I have no idea," the younger man said. "I have no theories."
"Try," said the older man. "We're just brainstorming. There are no wrong answers." This was not what the younger man had expected to hear, but he had no expectations at all, so it wasn't awkward or off-putting. He did what he was told. "I suppose it's possible that some millionaire might own a puma as an exotic pet, and he was hauling it across the country and it escaped from its cage in the cargo hold and crawled through the air conditioning vents, and it somehow ended up in the bathroom."
"Excellent," said the older man. "Let's have another." "I don't know. Maybe it prowled down from the Hollywood Hills and ended up at LAX, and it was drawn into the airplane hangar by the warmth of the cooling jet engines, but it got scared when the engines were restarted and scampered into the only cave-like crevice it could find, which was the restroom inside the aircraft."
"Less plausible," said the older man,
"but still possible. Keep going."
"Well, maybe this is a psychological experiment, and the puma is a trained puma, and I'm being watched. Maybe this is some kind of radical research project. And maybe you're the scientist who came up with the experiment, which is why you're seated next to me and asking these questions."
"That's compelling," said the older man. "But let me assure you, if this is a research project, I'm not part of it."
This whole section kind of strikes me as if it's kind of a writer's commentary track, because you're giving us access to your creative process and the questions that I imagine occurred to you while you were writing the story. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, I'm sure it is. Because, you know, when did I first think of this story? Well, in one sense, I probably don't know exactly, but it feels like I was probably on an airplane waiting to use the bathroom. And at one point I was like, what if I open that door and there's a puma in there? And then I started thinking, well, how could that happen, you know?
Yeah, yeah. This is the first book that you've written since you've moved from New York to Portland, Oregon in 2017. Is there something about moving from New York to the Pacific Northwest that has played a part in your writing this different kind of book?
You know, it must, because the only perspective you have is yours. So if you change everything about what you're experiencing through that perspective, it's going to shift. I do feel like, you know, when I lived in New York, I was probably overstimulated. Like, you know, you can't really live in New York and not constantly be encountering different people, different ideas. You know, the world is almost changing in front of you and with you. But now, there are many days where the only people I talk to are my wife, my kids, and maybe my kid's teacher, or maybe somebody who works at a diner or something. I'm much more inside my mind. There's more time where I'm by myself. And even though, I mean, it's odd because I've written a bunch of memoirs, but this feels like the most personal book I've done, because I really feel like it's about my interior life, where so many of the other books I wrote were about my exterior life.
Mm-hmm. In the acknowledgments, you thank anyone who has ever caused you to have a weird thought, which makes me wonder, who's the person? Is there a friend or a writer or a musician that has caused you to have the most weird thoughts in your life?
Now, that's a good question. The person who has made me have the most weird thoughts.
Yes.
You know, probably my wife.
Yeah.
She would be number one. I had some friends in college. One guy named Rex, one guy named Mr. Pancake, one guy named Mike. We had a lot of weird thoughts together. I had some friends in New York. A girl I used to hang out with, we used to party together. She was weird. Like, I don't really know. It probably is my wife, just from the pure magnitude of times we have talked about things by ourselves, just like sitting in the bedroom watching television.
A lot of these stories deal with ethics and morality. I'm thinking especially of the story Pain is a Concept by Which We Measure Our God, in which a couple considers getting a medical implant that will transfer the pain of childbirth from the woman to her husband. Now, I'm curious, did the idea for this story come out of the time you spent writing the ethicist column for the New York Times magazine?
No, that came out of just something that I have thought about for a while, which is, what are the responsibilities of loving someone? Like, once you make a commitment that you love someone, what are sort of the collective shared responsibilities we all have? And sometimes it seems like one of those things is the active willingness to accept your partner's pain and discomfort, you know, with your spouse, but also your kids or even your friends. Within the context of this story, it's like, okay, so there's a social pressure that if this existed, if it was possible for men to take away the pain of childbirth and they would feel it, the wife would be able to sort of use this device that would jump all the pain to the guy, there would be a huge amount of social pressure to do that. It would be perceived as incredibly unmasculine not to, you know. But in this story, like, the guy agrees to do this, and as you're filling out the paperwork, he starts getting these secondary thoughts. Like, you know, he's like, how do we know it's not supposed to be this way? Like, how do we know that pain isn't supposed to be part of childbirth, you know? And the wife is like, well, why would that be? Like, why would there be some sort of natural order to this? And he's like, I don't know. I don't know. It's like, you know? So I don't think it came out of doing the ethicist, but, you know, I mean, now that you're mentioning it, I suppose a lot of these stories may have fragments back from that period because, mm-hmm. you know, that was a time when I was thinking about ethical problems constantly. And in life, you always are, but I was thinking about ethical problems that didn't even apply to me. So there might be some residue of that.
Chuck Klosterman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Klosterman is a pop culture critic and the author of 12 books. His latest is Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. Find out more about Chuck at WPR.org/beta.
And to a lot of showrunners, that means whatever pain I have to drag myself through, whatever psychosis I have to relive, whatever trauma of my childhood I have to revisit on myself, I get to revisit on others so that they may suffer as I have, and that's how the show's going to get made.
TV writer and producer Javier Grillo marks watch on the toxic culture that lies behind many television shows. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Honestly, darling, I love you.